My eye, I see the other cycle come back. When they arrive, they are both glaring at me. Sylvia says,
We're just angry.
I shrug my shoulders and walk to the drinking fountain. John says, Where's all that stamina you were telling us about? I look at him for a second and see he really is angry. I was afraid you took that too seriously, I say, and then turn away. I drink the water, and it's alkaline, like soapy water. I drink it anyway. John goes into the building to soak his shirt with water. I check the oil level. The oil filter cap is so hot it burns my fingers right through the gloves. The engine hasn't lost much oil. The back tire tread is down a little more, but still serviceable. The chain is tight enough, but a little dry, so I oil it again to be safe. The critical bolts are all tight enough. John comes over, dripping with water, and says,
You go ahead this time. We'll stay behind.
I won't go fast, I say.
That's all right, he said. We'll get there.
So I go ahead, and we take it slowly. The road through the canyon doesn't straighten out into more of what we've been through, as I expected it would, but starts to wind upward. Surprise. Now the road meanders a little, now it cuts back away from the direction in which we should be going, then returns. Soon it rises a little, and then rises some more. We are moving in angular directions into narrow devil's gaps, then upward again, higher and a little higher each time. Some shrubs appear, then small trees. The road goes higher still into grass, and then fenced meadows. Overhead, a small cloud appears. Rain, perhaps? Perhaps. Meadows must have rain, and these now have flowers in them. Strange how all this has changed. Nothing to show it on the map, and the consciousness of memory has disappeared, too. Phaedrus must not have come this way. But there was no other road. Strange. It keeps rising upward. The sun angles toward the cloud, which now has grown downward, to touch the horizon above us, in which there are trees, pines, and a cold wind comes down with pine smells from the trees. The flowers in the meadow blow in the wind, and the cycle leans a little, and we are suddenly cool. I look at Chris, and he is smiling. I am smiling, too. Then the rain comes hard on the road with a gust of earth smell from the dust that has waited for too long, and the dust beside the road is pocked with the first raindrops. This is all so new. And we are so in need of it, a new rain. My clothes become wet, and goggles are spattered, and chills start and feel delicious. The cloud passes from beneath the sun, and the forest of pines and small meadows gleams again, sparkles where the sunlight catches small drops from the rain. We reach the top of the climb, dry again, but cool now, and stop, overlooking a huge valley and river below. I think we have arrived, John says. Sylvia and Chris have walked into the meadow among the flowers under pines through which I can see the far side of the valley, away and below. I'm a pioneer now, looking onto a promised land. Part 2 Chapter 8 It's about 10 o'clock in the morning, and I'm sitting alongside the machine on a cool, shady curbstone, back of a hotel we have found in Miles City, Montana. Sylvia is with Chris at a laundromat, doing the laundry for all of us. John is off looking for a duckbill to put on his helmet. He thought he saw one at a cycle shop when we came into town yesterday. And I'm about to sharpen up the engine a little. Feeling good now. We got in here in the afternoon and made up for a lot of sleep. It was a good thing we stopped. We were so stupid with exhaustion, we didn't know how tired we were. When John tried to register rooms, he couldn't even remember my name. The desk girl asked us if we owned those groovy, dreamy motorcycles outside the window, and we both laughed so hard she wondered what she had said wrong. It was just numbskull laughter from too much fatigue. We'd have been more than glad to leave them parked and walk for a change. And baths. In a beautiful old enameled cast-iron bathtub that crouched on lion's claws in the middle of a marble floor, just waiting for us. The water was so soft it felt as if I would never get the soap off. Afterward, we walked up and down the main streets and felt like a family. On this machine I've done the tuning so many times it's become a ritual. I don't have to think much about how to do it anymore. Just mainly look for anything unusual. The engine has picked up a noise that sounds like a loose tappet, but could be something worse, so I'm going to tune it now and see if it goes away. Tappet adjustment has to be done with the engine cold, which means wherever you park it for the night is where you work on it the next morning. Which is why I'm on a shady curbstone back of a hotel in Miles City, Montana. Right now, the air is cool in the shade, and will be for an hour or so until the sun gets around the tree branches, which is good for working on cycles. It's important not to tune these machines in the direct sun, or late in the day when your brain gets muddy, because even if you've been through it 100 times, you should be alert and looking for things. Not everyone understands what a completely rational process this is, this maintenance of a motorcycle. They think it's some kind of a knack, or some kind of affinity for machines in operation. They are right, but the knack is almost purely a process of reason, and most of the troubles are caused by what old-time radio men called a short between the earphones. Failures to use the head properly. A motorcycle functions entirely in accordance with the laws of reason, and a study of the art of motorcycle maintenance is really a miniature study of the art of rationality itself. I said yesterday that the ghost of rationality was what Phaedrus pursued, and what led to his insanity. But to get into that, it's vital to stay with down-to-earth examples of rationality, so as not to get lost in generalities no one else can understand. Talk about rationality can get very confusing unless the things with which rationality deals are also included. We are at the classic romantic barrier now, where on one side we see a cycle as it appears immediately, and this is an important way of seeing it, and where on the other side we can begin to see it as a mechanic does, in terms of underlying form, and this is an important way of seeing things too. These tools, for example, this wrench, has a certain romantic beauty to it, but its purpose is always purely classical. It's designed to change the underlying form of the machine. The porcelain inside this first plug is very dark. That is classically as well as romantically ugly because it means the cylinder is getting too much gas and not enough air. The carbon molecules in the gasoline aren't finding enough oxygen to combine with, and they're just sitting here, loading up the plug. Coming into town yesterday, the idle was loping a little, which is a symptom of the same thing. Just to see if it's just the one cylinder that's rich, I check the other one. They're both the same. I get out a pocket knife, grab a stick lying in the gutter, and whittle down the end to clean out the plugs, wondering what could be the cause of the richness. That wouldn't have anything to do with rods or valves. And carbs rarely go out of adjustment. The main jets are oversized, which causes richness at high speeds, but the plugs were a lot cleaner than before this, with the same jets. Mystery. You're always surrounded by them. But if you tried to solve them all, you'd never get the machine fixed. There's no immediate answer, so I just leave it as a hanging question. The first tappet is right on. No adjustment required. So I move on to the next. Still plenty of time before the sun gets past those trees. I always feel like I'm in church when I do this. The gauge is some kind of religious icon, and I'm performing a holy rite with it. It is a member of a set called precision measuring instruments, which in a classic sense has a profound meaning. In a motorcycle, this precision isn't maintained for any romantic or perfectionist reasons. It's simply that the enormous forces of heat and explosive pressure inside this engine can only be controlled through the kind of precision these instruments give. When each explosion takes place, it drives a connecting rod onto the crankshaft with a surface pressure of many tons per square inch. If the fit of the rod to the crankshaft is precise, the explosion force will be transferred smoothly and the metal will be able to stand it.
But if the fit is loose, by a distance of only a few thousandths of an inch, the force will be delivered suddenly, like a hammer blow, and the rod, bearing, and crankshaft surface will soon be pounded flat, creating a noise which at first sounds a lot like loose tappets. That's the reason I'm checking it now. If it is a loose rod, and I try to make it to the mountains without an overhaul, it will soon get louder and louder until the rod tears itself free, slams into the spinning crankshaft, and destroys the engine. Sometimes broken rods will pile right down through the crankcase and dump all the oil onto the road. All you can do then is start walking. But all this can be prevented by a few thousandths of an inch fit, which precision measuring instruments give, and this is their classical beauty. Not what you see, but what they mean, what they are capable of in terms of control of underlying form. The second tappet's fine. I swing over to the street side of the machine and start on the other cylinder. Precision instruments are designed to achieve an idea, dimensional precision, whose perfection is impossible. There is no perfectly shaped part of the motorcycle, and never will be. But when you come as close as these instruments take you, remarkable things happen, and you go flying across the countryside under a power that would be called magic if it were not so completely rational in every way. It's the understanding of this rational intellectual idea that's fundamental. John looks at the motorcycle and sees steel in various shapes and has negative feelings about these steel shapes, and turns off the whole thing. I look at the shapes of steel now, and I see ideas. He thinks I'm working on parts. I'm working on concepts. I was talking about these concepts yesterday when I said that a motorcycle can be divided according to its components and according to its functions. When I said that, suddenly I created a set of boxes with the following arrangement. Motorcycle as a sum of components and functions. And when I said the components may be subdivided into a power assembly and a running assembly, suddenly appear some more little boxes. Components as a sum of power assembly and running assembly, motorcycle as a sum of components and functions. And you see that every time I made a further division, up came more boxes based on these divisions until I had a huge pyramid of boxes. Finally, you see that while I was splitting the cycle up into finer and finer pieces, I was also building a structure. This structure of concepts is formally called a hierarchy, and since ancient times has been a basic structure for all Western knowledge. Kingdoms, empires, churches, armies have all been structured into hierarchies. Modern businesses are so structured. Tables of contents of reference material are so structured. Mechanical assemblies, computer software, all scientific and technical knowledge is so structured. So much so that in some fields, such as biology, the hierarchy of kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species is almost an icon. The box motorcycle contains the box's components and functions. The box components contains the box's power assembly and running assembly, and so on. There are many other kinds of structures produced by other operators, such as causes, which produce long chain structures of the form A causes B, which causes C, which causes D, and so on. A functional description of the motorcycle uses this structure. The operator's exists, equals, and implies produce still other structures. These structures are normally interrelated in patterns and paths so complex and so enormous, no one person can understand more than a small part of them in his lifetime. The overall name of these interrelated structures, the genus of which the hierarchy of containment and structure of causation are just species, is system. The motorcycle is a system, a real system. To speak of certain government and establishment institutions as the system is to speak correctly, since these organizations are founded upon the same structural conceptual relationships as a motorcycle. They are sustained by structural relationships even when they have lost all other meaning and purpose.
People arrive at a factory and perform a totally meaningless task from 8 to 5 without question because the structure demands that it be that way. There's no villain, no mean guy who wants them to live meaningless lives. It's just that the structure, the system, demands it, and no one is willing to take on the formidable task of changing the structure just because it is meaningless. But to tear down a factory, or to revolt against a government, or to avoid repair of a motorcycle because it is a system, is to attack effects rather than causes. And as long as the attack is upon effects only, no change is possible. The true system, the real system, is our present construction of systematic thought itself, rationality itself. And if a factory is torn down, but the rationality which produced it is left standing, then that rationality will simply produce another factory. If a revolution destroys a systematic government, but the systematic patterns of thought that produce that government are left intact, then those patterns will repeat themselves in the succeeding government. There's so much talk about the system, and so little understanding. That's all the motorcycle is. A system of concepts worked out in steel. There's no part in it, no shape in it, that is not out of someone's mind. Number 3 Tappet is right on, too. One more to go. This had better be it. I've noticed that people who have never worked with steel have trouble seeing this, that the motorcycle is primarily a mental phenomenon. They associate metal with given shapes. Pipes, rods, girders, tools, parts, all of them fixed and inviolable, and think of it as primarily physical. But a person who does machining or foundry work or forge work or welding sees steel as having no shape at all. Steel can be any shape you want if you are skilled enough, and any shape but the one you want if you are not. Shapes, like this tappet, are what you arrive at, what you give to the steel. Steel has no more shape than this old pile of dirt on the engine here. These shapes are all out of someone's mind. That's important to see. The steel? Hell, even the steel is out of someone's mind. There's no steel in nature. Anyone from the Bronze Age could have told you that. All nature has is a potential for steel. There's nothing else there. But what's potential? That's also in someone's mind. Ghosts. That's really what Phaedrus was talking about when he said it's all in the mind. It sounds insane when you just jump up and say it without reference to anything specific like an engine. But when you tie it down to something specific and concrete, the insane sound tends to disappear, and you see he could have been saying something of importance. The 4th tappet is too loose, which is what I had hoped. I adjust it. I check the timing and see that it is still right on, and the points are not pitted. So I leave them alone, screw on the valve covers, replace the plugs, and start it up. The tappet noise is gone, but that doesn't mean much yet, while the oil is still cold. I let it idle while I pack the tools away, then climb on and head for a cycle shop a cyclist on the street told us about last night, where they may have a chain adjuster link and a new foot peg rubber. Chris must have nervous feet. His foot pegs keep wearing out. I go a couple blocks and still no tappet noise. It's beginning to sound good. I think it's gone. I won't come to any conclusions until we've gone about 30 miles, though. But until then, and right now, the sun is bright, the air is cool, my head is clear, there's a whole day ahead of us, we're almost to the mountains. It's a good day to be alive. It's this thinner air that does it. You always feel like this when you start getting into higher altitudes. The altitude. That's why the engine's running rich. Sure, that's got to be the reason. We're at 2,500 feet now. I'd better switch to standard jets. They take only a few minutes to put in. And lean out the idle adjustment a little. We'll be getting up a lot higher than this. Under some shady trees, I find Bill's cycle shop, but no Bill. A passerby says he has maybe gone fishing somewhere, leaving his shop wide open. We really are in the West. No one will leave a shop like this open in Chicago or New York. Inside, I see that Bill is a mechanic of the Photographic Mind School. Everything lying around everywhere. Wrenches, screwdrivers, old parts, old motorcycles, new parts, new motorcycles, sales literature, inner tubes. All scattered so thickly and clutteredly, you can't even see the workbenches under them. I couldn't work in conditions like this, but that's just because I'm not a photographic mind mechanic. Bill can probably turn around and put his hand on any tool in this mess without having to think about where it is. I've seen mechanics like that. Drive you crazy to watch them, but they get the job done just as well, and sometimes faster. Move one tool 3 inches to the left, though, and you'll have to spend days looking for it. Bill arrives with a grin about something. Sure, he's got some jets for my machine and knows right where they are. I'll have to wait a second, though. He's got to close a deal out and back on some Harley parts. I go with him out in a shed and back, and see he is selling a whole Harley machine and used parts, except for the frame, which the customer already has. He is selling them all for $125. Not a bad price at all. Coming back, I comment, "He'll know something about motorcycles before he gets those together." Bill laughs. "And that's the best way to learn, too." He has the jets and foot peg rubber, but no chain adjuster link. I get the rubber and jets installed, take the lump out of the idle, and ride back to the hotel. Sylvia and John and Chris are just coming down the stairs with their stuff as I arrive. Their faces indicate they're in the same good mood I'm in. We head down the main street, find a restaurant, and order steaks for lunch. "This is a great town," John says. "Really great. Surprised there were any like this left. I was looking all over this morning. They've got Stockman's bars, high-top boots, silver dollar belt buckles, Levi's, Stetsons, the whole thing. And it's real. It isn't just Chamber of Commerce stuff. In the bar down the block this morning, they just started talking to me like I'd lived here all my life." We order a round of beers. I see by a horseshoe sign on the wall we're in Olympia beer territory now, and order that. "They must have thought I was off a ranch or something," John continues. "And this one old guy was talking away about how he wasn't going to give a thing to the goddamn boys, and I really enjoyed that. The ranch was going to go to the girls, 'cause the goddamn boys spend every cent they got down at Susie's." John breaks up with laughter. "Sorry he ever raised 'em, and so on. I thought all that stuff disappeared 30 years ago, but it's still here." The waitress comes with the steaks, and we knife right into them. That work on the cycle has given me an appetite. "Something else that ought to interest you," John says. "They were talking in the bar about Bozeman, where we're going. They said the governor of Montana had a list of 50 radical college professors at the college in Bozeman he was going to fire. Then he got killed in a plane crash." "That was a long time ago," I answer. "These steaks really are good." "I didn't know they had a lot of radicals in this state." "They've got all kinds of people in this state," I say. "But that was just right-wing politics." John helps himself to some more salt. He says, "A Washington newspaper columnist came through and put it in his column yesterday, and that's why they were all talking about it. The president of the college confirmed it." "Did they print the list?" "I don't know. Do you know any of them?" "If they had 50 names," I say, "mine must have been one." They both look at me with some surprise. "I don't know much about it, actually." It was him, of course, and with some feeling of falseness because of this, I explain that a radical in Gallatin County, Montana, is a little different from a radical somewhere else. "This was a college," I tell them, "where the wife of the President of the United States was actually banned because she was too controversial."
"Who?"
"Eleanor Roosevelt."
"Oh, my God," John laughs. "That must have been wild."
They want to hear more, but it's hard to say anything. Then I remember one thing. In a situation like that, a real radical's actually got a perfect setup. He can do almost anything and get away with it because his opposition have already made asses out of themselves. They'll make him look good no matter what he says. On the way out, we pass a city park, which I noticed last night, and which produced a memory concurrence. Just a vision of looking up into some trees. He had slept on that park bench one night on his way through to Bozeman. That's why I didn't recognize that forest yesterday. He'd come through at night, on his way to the college at Bozeman. Chapter 9. Now we follow the Yellowstone Valley right across Montana. It changes from western sagebrush to midwestern cornfields and back again, depending on whether it's under irrigation from the river. Sometimes we cross over bluffs that take us out of the irrigated area, but usually we stay close to the river. We pass by a marker saying something about Lewis and Clark. One of them came up this way on a side excursion from the Northwest Passage. Nice sound. Fits the Chautauqua. We're really on a kind of Northwest Passage, too. We pass through more fields and desert, and the day wears on. I want to pursue further now that same ghost that Phaedrus pursued, rationality itself, that dull, complex, classical ghost of underlying form. This morning I talked about hierarchies of thought, the system. Now I want to talk about methods of finding one's way through these hierarchies. Logic. Two kinds of logic are used, inductive and deductive. Inductive inferences start with observations of the machine and arrive at general conclusions. For example, if the cycle goes over a bump and the engine misfires, and then goes over another bump and the engine misfires, and then goes over another bump and the engine misfires, and then goes over a long, smooth stretch of road, and there is no misfiring, and then goes over a fourth bump, and the engine misfires again, one can logically conclude that the misfiring is caused by the bumps. That is induction. Reasoning from particular experiences to general truths. Deductive inferences do the reverse. They start with general knowledge and predict a specific observation. For example, if, from reading the hierarchy of facts about the machine, the mechanic knows the horn of the cycle is powered exclusively by electricity from the battery, then he can logically infer that if the battery is dead, the horn will not work. That is deduction. Solution of problems too complicated for common sense to solve is achieved by long strings of mixed inductive and deductive inferences that weave back and forth between the observed machine and the mental hierarchy of the machine found in the manuals. The correct program for this interweaving is formalized as scientific method. Actually, I've never seen a cycle maintenance problem complex enough really to require full-scale formal scientific method. Repair problems are not that hard. When I think of formal scientific method, an image sometimes comes to mind of an enormous juggernaut, a huge bulldozer, slow, tedious, lumbering, laborious, but invincible. It takes twice as long, five times as long, maybe a dozen times as long as informal mechanics techniques. But you know in the end you're going to get it. There's no fault isolation problem in motorcycle maintenance that can stand up to it. When you've hit a really tough one, tried everything, racked your brain, and nothing works, and you know that this time nature has really decided to be difficult, you say, okay, nature, that's the end of the nice guy, and you crank up the formal scientific method. For this, you keep a lab notebook. Everything gets written down, formally, so that you know at all times where you are, where you've been, where you're going, and where you want to get. In scientific work and electronics technology, this is necessary because otherwise the problems get so complex, you get lost in them and confused, and forget what you know and what you don't know and have to give up. In cycle maintenance, things are not that involved, but when confusion starts, it's a good idea to hold it down by making everything formal and exact. Sometimes just the act of writing down the problems straightens out your head as to what they really are. The logical statements entered into the notebook are broken down into six categories. 1. Statement of the problem. 2. Hypotheses as to the cause of the problem. 3. Experiments designed to test each hypothesis. 4. Predicted results of the experiments. 5. Observed results of the experiments. And 6. Conclusions from the results of the experiments. This is not different from the formal arrangement of many college and high school lab notebooks, but the purpose here is no longer just busy work. The purpose now is precise guidance of thoughts that will fail if they are not accurate. The real purpose of scientific method is to make sure nature hasn't misled you into thinking you know something you don't actually know. There's not a mechanic or scientist or technician alive who hasn't suffered from that one so much that he's not instinctively on guard. That's the main reason why so much scientific and mechanical information sounds so dull and so cautious. If you get careless or go romanticizing scientific information, giving it a flourish here and there, nature will soon make a complete fool out of you. It does it often enough anyway, even when you don't give it opportunities. One must be extremely careful and rigidly logical when dealing with nature. One logical slip and an entire scientific edifice comes tumbling down. One false deduction about the machine, and you can get hung up indefinitely. In part one of formal scientific method, which is the statement of the problem, the main skill is in stating absolutely no more than you are positive you know. It is much better to enter a statement, solve problem. Why doesn't cycle work, which sounds dumb but is correct, than it is to enter a statement, solve problem. What is wrong with the electrical system, when you don't absolutely know the trouble is in the electrical system? What you should state is, solve problem, what is wrong with cycle, and then state, as the first entry of part two, hypothesis number one, the trouble is in the electrical system. You think of as many hypotheses as you can, then you design experiments to test them to see which are true and which are false. This careful approach to the beginning questions keeps you from taking a major wrong turn, which might cause you weeks of extra work, or can even hang you up completely. Scientific questions often have a surface appearance of dumbness for this reason. They are asked in order to prevent dumb mistakes later on. Part three, that part of formal scientific method called experimentation, is sometimes thought of by romantics as all of science itself, because that's the only part with much visual surface. They see lots of test tubes and bizarre equipment and people running around making discoveries. They do not see the experiment as part of a larger intellectual process, and so they often confuse experiments with demonstrations, which look the same. A man conducting a gee-whiz science show with $50,000 worth of Frankenstein equipment is not doing anything scientific, if he knows beforehand what the results of his efforts are going to be. A motorcycle mechanic, on the other hand, who honks the horn to see if the battery works, is informally conducting a true scientific experiment. He is testing a hypothesis by putting the question to nature. The TV scientist who mutters sadly, "The experiment is a failure. We have failed to achieve what we had hoped for," is suffering mainly from a bad scriptwriter. An experiment is never a failure solely because it fails to achieve predicted results. An experiment is a failure only when it also fails adequately to test the hypothesis in question, when the data it produces don't prove anything one way or another. Skill at this point consists of using experiments that test only the hypothesis in question, nothing less, nothing more. If the horn honks and the mechanic concludes that the whole electrical system is working, he is in deep trouble. He has reached an illogical conclusion. The honking horn only tells him that the battery and horn are working. To design an experiment properly, he has to think very rigidly in terms of what directly causes what. This you know from the hierarchy. The horn doesn't make the cycle go, neither does the battery, except in a very indirect way. The point at which the electrical system directly causes the engine to fire is at the spark plugs. And if you don't test here, at the output of the electrical system, you will never really know whether the failure is electrical or not. To test properly, the mechanic removes the plug and lays it against the engine so that the base around the plug is electrically grounded, kicks the starter lever, and watches the spark plug gap for a blue spark. If there isn't any, he can conclude one of two things. A, there is an electrical failure, or B, his experiment is sloppy. If he is experienced, he will try it a few more times, checking connections, trying every way he can think of, to get that plug to fire. Then, if he can't get it to fire, he finally concludes that A is correct. There's an electrical failure, and the experiment is over. He has proved that his hypothesis is correct. In the final category, conclusions, skill comes in stating no more than the experiment has proved. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig continued. Cassette 3, Side 2. In the final category, conclusions, skill comes in stating no more than the experiment has proved. It hasn't proved that when he fixes the electrical system, the motorcycle will start. There may be other things wrong. But he does know that the motorcycle isn't going to run until the electrical system is working, and he sets up the next formal question. Solve problem. What is wrong with the electrical system? He then sets up hypotheses for these and tests them. By asking the right questions and choosing the right tests and drawing the right conclusions, the mechanic works his way down the echelons of the motorcycle hierarchy until he has found the exact specific cause or causes of the engine failure, and then he changes them so that they no longer cause the failure. An untrained observer will see only physical labor and often get the idea that physical labor is mainly what the mechanic does. Actually, the physical labor is the smallest and easiest part of what the mechanic does. By far the greatest part of his work is careful observation and precise thinking. That is why mechanics sometimes seem so taciturn and withdrawn when performing tests. They don't like it when you talk to them because they are concentrating on mental images, hierarchies, and not really looking at you or the physical motorcycle at all. They are using the experiment as part of a program to expand their hierarchy of knowledge of the faulty motorcycle and compare it to the correct hierarchy in their mind. They are looking at underlying form. A car with a trailer coming our way is passing and having trouble getting back into his lane. I flash my headlight to make sure he sees us. He sees us, but he can't get back in. The shoulder is narrow and bumpy. It'll spill us if we take it. I'm braking, honking, flashing. Christ almighty, he panics and heads for our shoulder. I hold steady to the edge of the road. Here he comes. At the last moment, he goes back and misses us by inches. A cardboard carton flaps and rolls in the road ahead of us, and we watch it for a long time before we come to it. Fallen off somebody's truck, evidently. Now the shakes come. If we'd been in a car, that would have been a head-on, or a roll in the ditch. We pull off into a little town that could be in the middle of Iowa. The corn is growing high all around, and the smell of fertilizer is heavy in the air. We retreat from the parked cycles into an enormous high-ceilinged old place. To go with the beer, this time I order every kind of snack they've got, and we have a late lunch on peanuts, popcorn, pretzels, potato chips, dried anchovies, dried smoked fish of some other kind with a lot of fine little bones in it, Slim Jims, Long Johns, pepperoni, Fritos, beer nuts, ham sausage spread, fried pork rind, and some sesame crackers, with an extra taste I'm unable to identify. Sylvia says, "I'm still feeling weak." She somehow thought that cardboard box was our motorcycle rolling over and over again on the highway. Chapter 10. Outside, in the valley again, the sky is still limited by the bluffs on either side of the river. But they are closer together and closer to us than they were this morning. The valley is narrowing as we move toward the river's source. We're also at a kind of beginning point in the things I'm discussing, at which one can at last start to talk about Phaedrus's break from the mainstream of rational thought in pursuit of the ghost of rationality itself. There was a passage he had read and repeated to himself so many times it survives intact. It begins, "In the temple of science are many mansions, and various indeed are they that dwell therein, and the motives that have led them there. Many take to science out of a joyful sense of superior intellectual power. Science is their own special sport, to which they look for vivid experience and the satisfaction of ambition. Many others are to be found in the temple who have offered the products of their brains on this altar for purely utilitarian purposes. Were an angel of the Lord to come and drive all the people belonging to these two categories out of the temple, It would be noticeably emptier, but there would still be some men of both present and past times left inside. If the types we have just expelled were the only types there were, the temple would never have existed any more than one can have a wood consisting of nothing but creepers. Those who have found favor with the angel are somewhat odd, uncommunicative, solitary fellows, really less like each other than the hosts of the rejected. What has brought them to the temple? No single answer will cover. Escape from everyday life, with its painful crudity and hopeless dreariness, from the fetters of one's own shifting desires. A finely tempered nature longs to escape from his noisy, cramped surroundings into the silence of the high mountains, where the eye ranges freely through the still pure air and fondly traces out the restful contours apparently built for eternity. The passage is from a 1918 speech by a young German scientist named Albert Einstein. Phaedrus had finished his first year of university science at the age of 15. His field was already biochemistry, and he intended to specialize at the interface between the organic and inorganic worlds, now known as molecular biology. He didn't think of this as a career for his own personal achievement. He was very young, and it was a kind of noble, idealistic goal. The state of mind which enables a man to do work of this kind is akin to that of the religious worshipper or lover. The daily effort comes from no deliberate intention or program, but straight from the heart. If Phaedrus had entered science for ambitious or utilitarian purposes, it might never have occurred to him to ask questions about the nature of a scientific hypothesis as an entity in itself. But he did ask them, and was unsatisfied with the answers. The formation of hypotheses is the most mysterious of all the categories of scientific method. Where they come from, no one knows. A person is sitting somewhere, minding his own business, and suddenly, flash! He understands something he didn't understand before. Until it's tested, the hypothesis isn't truth. For the tests aren't its source. Its source is somewhere else. Einstein had said, "Man tries to make for himself in the fashion that suits him best a simplified and intelligible picture of the world. He then tries to some extent to substitute this cosmos of his for the world of experience, and thus to overcome it. He makes this cosmos and its construction the pivot of his emotional life in order to find in this way the peace and serenity which he cannot find in the narrow whirlpool of personal experience. The supreme task is to arrive at those universal elementary laws from which the cosmos can be built up by pure deduction. There is no logical path to these laws. Only intuition, resting on sympathetic understanding of experience, can reach them." Intuition? Sympathy? Strange words for the origin of scientific knowledge. A lesser scientist than Einstein might have said, "But scientific knowledge comes from nature. Nature provides the hypotheses." But Einstein understood that nature does not. Nature provides only experimental data. A lesser mind might then have said, "Well then, man provides the hypotheses." But Einstein denied this too. "Nobody," he said, "who has really gone into the matter will deny that in practice the world of phenomena uniquely determines the theoretical system, in spite of the fact that there is no theoretical bridge between phenomena and their theoretical principles." Phaedrus's break occurred when, as a result of laboratory experience, he became interested in hypotheses as entities in themselves. He had noticed again and again in his lab work that what might seem to be the hardest part of scientific work, thinking up the hypotheses, was invariably the easiest. The act of formally writing everything down precisely and clearly seemed to suggest them. As he was testing hypothesis number one by experimental method, a flood of other hypotheses would come to mind, and as he was testing these, some more came to mind. And as he was testing these, still more came to mind, until it became painfully evident that as he continued testing hypotheses and eliminating them, or confirming them, their number did not decrease. It actually increased as he went along. At first he found it amusing. He coined a law, intended to have the humor of a Parkinson's law, that the number of rational hypotheses that can explain any given phenomenon is infinite. It pleased him never to run out of hypotheses. Even when his experimental work seemed dead-end in every conceivable way, he knew that if he just sat down and muddled about it long enough, sure enough, another hypothesis would come along. And it always did. It was only months after he had coined the law that he began to have some doubts about the humor or benefits of it. If true, that law is not a minor flaw in scientific reasoning. The law is completely nihilistic. It is a catastrophic, logical disproof of the general validity of all scientific method. If the purpose of scientific method is to select from among a multitude of hypotheses, and if the number of hypotheses grows faster than experimental method can handle, then it is clear that all hypotheses can never be tested. If all hypotheses cannot be tested, then the results of any experiment are inconclusive and the entire scientific method falls short of its goal of establishing proven knowledge. About this, Einstein had said, "Evolution has shown that at any given moment, out of all conceivable constructions, a single one has always proved itself absolutely superior to the rest," and let it go at that. But to Phaedrus, that was an incredibly weak answer. The phrase, at any given moment, really shook him. Did Einstein really mean to state that truth was a function of time? To state that would annihilate the most basic presumption of all science. But there it was, the whole history of science, a clear story of continuously new and changing explanations of old facts. The time spans of permanence seemed completely random. He could see no order in them. Some scientific truths seemed to last for centuries, others for less than a year. Scientific truth was not dogma, good for eternity, but a temporal, quantitative entity that could be studied like anything else. He studied scientific truths, then became upset even more by the apparent cause of their temporal condition. It looked as though the time spans of scientific truths are an inverse function of the intensity of scientific effort. Thus, the scientific truths of the 20th century seem to have a much shorter lifespan than those of the last century because scientific activity is now much greater. If, in the next century, scientific activity increases tenfold, then the life expectancy of any scientific truth can be expected to drop to perhaps one-tenth as long as now. What shortens the lifespan of the existing truth is the volume of hypotheses offered to replace it. The more the hypotheses, the shorter the time span of the truth. And what seems to be causing the number of hypotheses to grow in recent decades seems to be nothing other than scientific method itself. The more you look, the more you see. Instead of selecting one truth from a multitude, you are increasing the multitude. What this means logically is that, as you try to move toward unchanging truth through the application of scientific method, you actually do not move toward it at all. You move away from it. It is your application of scientific method that is causing it to change. What Phaedrus observed on a personal level was a phenomenon profoundly characteristic of the history of science, which has been swept under the carpet for years. The predicted results of scientific inquiry and the actual results of scientific inquiry are diametrically opposed here, and no one seems to pay too much attention to the fact. The purpose of scientific method is to select a single truth from among many hypothetical truths. That, more than anything else, is what science is all about. But historically, science has done exactly the opposite. Through multiplication upon multiplication of facts, information, theories, and hypotheses, it is science itself that is leading mankind from single absolute truths to multiple, indeterminate, relative ones. The major producer of the social chaos, the indeterminacy of thought and values that rational knowledge is supposed to eliminate, is none other than science itself. And what Phaedrus saw in the isolation of his own laboratory work years ago is now seen everywhere in the technological world today. Scientifically produced anti-science, chaos, It's possible now to look back a little and see why it's important to talk about this person in relation to everything that's been said before, concerning the division between classic and romantic realities and the irreconcilability of the two. Unlike the multitude of romantics who are disturbed about the chaotic changes science and technology force upon the human spirit, Phaedrus, with his scientifically trained classic mind, was able to do more than just wring his hands with dismay, or run away, or condemn the whole situation broadside without offering any solutions. As I've said, he did in the end offer a number of solutions, but the problem was so deep and so formidable and complex that no one really understood the gravity of what he was resolving, and so failed to understand or misunderstood what he said. "The cause of our current social crises," he would have said, "is a genetic defect within the nature of reason itself. And until this genetic defect is cleared, the crises will continue. Our current modes of rationality are not moving society forward into a better world. They are taking it further and further from that better world. Since the Renaissance, these modes have worked. As long as the need for food, clothing, and shelter is dominant, they will continue to work. But now that, for huge masses of people, these needs no longer overwhelm everything else, the whole structure of reason, handed down to us from ancient times, is no longer adequate. It begins to be seen for what it really is, emotionally hollow, aesthetically meaningless, and spiritually empty. That, today, is where it is at, and will continue to be at for a long time to come. I've a vision of an angry, continuing social crisis that no one really understands the depth of, let alone has solutions to. I see people like John and Sylvia living lost and alienated from the whole rational structure of civilized life, looking for solutions outside that structure, but finding none that are really satisfactory for long. And then I've a vision of Phaedrus and his lone, isolated abstractions in the laboratory, actually concerned with the same crisis, but starting from another point, moving in the opposite direction. And what I'm trying to do here is put it all together. It's so big, that's why I seem to wander sometimes. No one that Phaedrus talked to seemed really concerned about this phenomenon that so baffled him. They seemed to say, "We know scientific method is valid, so why ask about it?" Phaedrus didn't understand this attitude, didn't know what to do about it. And because he wasn't a student of science for personal or utilitarian reasons, it just stopped him completely. It was as if he were contemplating that serene mountain landscape Einstein had described, and suddenly between the mountains had appeared a fissure, a gap of pure nothing. And slowly and agonizingly, to explain this gap, he had to admit that the mountains, which had seemed built for eternity, might possibly be something else, perhaps just figments of his own imagination. It stopped him. And so Phaedrus, who at the age of 15 had finished his freshman year of science, was at the age of 17 expelled from the university for failing grades. Immaturity and inattention to studies were given as official causes. There was nothing anyone could have done about it, either to prevent it or correct it. The university couldn't have kept him on without abandoning standards completely. In a stunned state, Phaedrus began a long series of lateral drifts that led him into a far orbit of the mind, but he eventually returned along a route we are now following to the doors of the university itself. Tomorrow, I'll try to start on that route. At Laurel, in the sight of the mountains at last, we stop for the night. The evening breeze is cool now. It comes down off the snow. Although the sun must have disappeared behind the mountains an hour ago, there's still good light in the sky from behind the range. Sylvia and John and Chris and I walk up along the main street in the gathering dusk and feel the presence of the mountains, even though we talk about other things. I feel happy to be here, and still a little sad to be here, too. Sometimes it's a little better to travel than to arrive. Chapter 11. I wake up wondering if I know we're near the mountains because of memory or because of something in the air. We're in a beautiful old wooden room of a hotel. The sun is shining on the dark wood through the window shade, but even with the shade drawn, I can sense that we're near mountains. There's mountain air in this room. It's cool and moist and almost fragrant. One deep breath makes me ready for the next one, and then the next one. And with each deep breath, I feel a little readier. Until I jump out of bed and pull up the shade and let all that sunlight in. Brilliant, cool, bright, sharp, and clear. An urge grows to go over and push Chris up and down to bounce him awake to see all this. But out of kindness, or respect maybe, he is allowed to sleep a while longer, and so with razor and soap I go to a common washroom at the other end of a long corridor of the same dark wood, floorboards creaking all the way. In the washroom, the hot water is steaming and perking in the pipes, too hot at first for shaving, but fine after I mix it with cold water. Through the window beyond the mirror, I see there is a porch out and back, and when done, go out and stand on it. It's at a level with the tops of the trees surrounding the hotel, which seem to respond to this morning air the same way I do. The branches and leaves move with each light breeze, as if it were expected, or what had been waited for all this time. Chris is soon up, and Sylvia comes out of her room saying she and John have already eaten breakfast, and he is out walking somewhere, but she will go with Chris and me and walk down with us to breakfast. We are in love with everything this morning and talk about good things all the way down a sunlit morning street to a restaurant. The eggs and hot cakes and coffee are from heaven. Sylvia and Chris talk intimately about his school and friends and personal things, while I listen and gaze through the large restaurant window at the storefront across the road. So different now from that lonely night in South Dakota. Beyond those buildings are mountains and snowfields. Sylvia says John has talked to someone in town about another route to Bozeman, south through Yellowstone Park. South, I say. You mean Red Lodge?
I guess so.
A memory comes to me of snowfields in June. That road goes way up above the timberline.
Is that bad? Sylvia asks.
It'll be cold. In the middle of the snowfields in my mind appear the cycles and us riding on them. But just tremendous. We meet John again, and it's settled. Soon, beyond a railroad underpass, we are on a twisting blacktop through fields toward the mountains up ahead. This is a road Phaedrus used all the time, and flashes of his memory coincide everywhere. The high, dark Absarica Range looms directly ahead. We are following a creek to its source. It contains water that was probably snow less than an hour ago. The stream and the road pass through green and stony fields, each a little higher than before. Everything is so intense in this sunlight. Dark shadows, bright light. Dark blue sky. The sun is bright and hot when we're in it, but when we pass under trees along the road, it's suddenly cold. We play tag with a little blue Porsche along the way, passing it with a beep and being passed by it with a beep, and doing this several times through fields of dark aspen and bright greens of grass and mountain shrubs. All this is remembered. He would use this route to get into the high country, then backpack in from the road for 3 or 4 or 5 days, then come back out for more food and head back in again, needing these mountains in an almost physiological way. The train of his abstractions became so long and so involved, he had to have the surroundings of silence and space here to hold it straight. It was as though hours of constructions would have been shattered by the least distraction of other thought or other duty. It wasn't like other people's thinking, even then, before his insanity. It was at a level at which everything shifts and changes, at which institutional values and verities are gone, and there is nothing but one's own spirit to keep one going. His early failure had released him from any felt obligation to think along institutional lines, and his thoughts were already independent to a degree few people are familiar with. He felt that institutions such as schools, churches, governments, and political organizations of every sort all tended to direct thought for ends other than truth, for the perpetuation of their own functions, or for the control of individuals in the service of these functions. He came to see his early failure as a lucky break, an accidental escape from a trap that had been set for him, and he was very trap-wary about institutional truths for the remainder of his time. He didn't see these things and think this way at first, however, only later on. I'm getting way out of sequence here. This all came much later.